You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is the 3rd of June 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, on Radio Aryan. As always today, I have the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told with me. Dennis, how are you doing today?
We're fine. The weather's wonderful. Sun is shining. Couldn't be happier.
It's an absolutely glorious day here too, but unfortunately we don't have Messerschmitt with us this week, and I am wondering whether he's gone swimming or canoeing, perhaps. Maybe that's a little bit cruel, but we're so used to having such bad weather over here in Britain, it makes a change for it to be happening just over the pond. Normally they're having glorious sunshine, aren't they?
It'd be perfect if it were in the EU. Absolutely perfect.
Well, we're going to have to do a programme on the EU, I think, before before they actually have the Brexit vote. But today, or this week's episode, we thought what we would concentrate on is the release of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, back on YouTube. It's been up now for about a month, and there's, 12,205 comments on it, and there's 831,731 views. So getting pretty close to a million views there. And looking through these comments, some of them are quite interesting. Some of our listeners probably know the answers to some of them, but we also thought it would be interesting just to point out some of these comments and answer them, and I'll sort of read them out, and then Dennis can answer the question, and hopefully it'll be a useful podcast for people to use, for people that are new to this and have questions about it, and hopefully some of these comments that they've made will be questions that people have themselves. Some of them are quite they rely on a bit of knowledge about it, and others are quite general ones, just about National Socialism or about Hitler. And the first one that we have here is from David JSR, and he's talking about the Gleiwitz incident, and he claims that the National Socialists staged a false flag after making a peace treaty with the Soviets, and they staged this Gleiwitz incident, and that was so that they could go to war because they were such desperate warmongers. So what would your answer be to that, Dennis?
Well, it looks to me like it was the excuse of the Allies of why they needed an excuse of why Germany was invading Poland. And this is the idea they came up with, that there would be a false flag. The Germans, they claim, dressed up in Polish uniforms, stormed apparently a radio station, a German radio station, and pretended to be Poles. And this was the incident then which allowed Hitler to finally invade Poland after months of threats. But obviously, you know, you can find out these days, since that time, you know, there's enough proof now to say that the Germans were going into Germany to save the ethnics. But this is one of them, you know, I mean, it's such a clumsy story as well, because they were supposed to announce this thing over the radio, to, you know, but nobody actually heard it, and nobody can ever remember hearing it. And there are a few things really what are quite laughable now when you look at the story. They're supposed to, they took some photos of some dead bodies, they're supposed to took it back to the Gestapo, and the Gestapo said, oh, these aren't good enough, so they went back and took another set of photographs, but then they never got released. And it's just a comical thing, you know, for to actually base that on a country invading another. Ludicrous, in fact. But many people believe it.
So you think that what they were trying to do is cover up what was happening in Danzig? Because there's another comment later on that I was going to ask you about, where someone was talking about Danzig and saying that that didn't happen until after the war had started. Now, the Danzig question was an area of Germany that had been given to Poland after the war, and it had German people in it, and Germany couldn't had no way of getting to there. They wanted to put a railway line there, and then they would have access to the German people. And the Poles had been putting all these tariffs on trade, and then they started violently attacking the people. And we have lots of evidence and documents to show that the Poles had been brutally treating these Germans, murdering them and doing horrific things to them, torturing the bodies. And they gave them an ultimatum, basically. I mean, Hitler had made so many offers to sort out this Danzig question, and he said, well, look, let's meet together, we'll meet on this time, because it's got so bad now. We've got hundreds of thousands of German refugees that are coming from that area, and there are people, and you're supposed to be looking after them. But Poland had been given a blank check, basically, to rub Germany up the wrong way, because Britain and France had said, look, we'll back you up if you can push them into a war. So they signed a thing saying that they'd back Poland up no matter what happened. So Poland sort of puffed their chest out and said, no, we're not going to have a peace talk with you about Danzig. And Hitler said, well, look, you've got 24 hours to get here to sort this out, because otherwise we're going to have to come in to get our German people. I'm not standing for it any longer, this horrific treatment. And the Poles didn't turn up. And Hitler went in to, you know, do what he said he was going to do, save his German people. That's my understanding of it anyway.
One of the best interviews that I found on YouTube was the guy who wrote The War Had Many Fathers. And although it's in German, there is English subtitles. And he goes into great depth in this, it's not an interview, it's more of a talk he's given. And he explains in great detail how the last few weeks before the invasion, how hard Hitler strove to get peace. And he talks about how the books had all been changed, and even Hitler's speeches had been changed, all proven in this book. I think it has English translations now on Amazon. But it's a fabulous piece on YouTube where he's talking about it. And he actually says that for the last week, the Poles wouldn't talk to the Germans at all. The British had more or less said, whatever you do, don't come to a deal. And the Poles just refused to talk, which left the Germans actually talking to the English, third party, which couldn't go on, obviously, with what was going on. And another, as I was watching clips from The World at War, the Thames television epic from the 70s, a lot of people remember, and probably the defining story for the Allies version anyway, during the 1970s and for a lot of people. And even they have, it shows footage of these German refugees turning up on the border. And they're calling it this great myth of the Polish persecutions. And they've actually got Germans there breaking down in tears and explaining to the cameras what's been going on. And they're just refusing to say that it's true. So I suppose they did show some of it, but they kind of denounced it as they showed it.
Well, I think the documents to prove all of this, the Germans got together all the documents to prove all of it. I believe it's called the White Book or the White Papers.
And yeah, you can find it. Wikipedia, you can get it on, yeah.
Yeah, well, you can find a copy of it at NS Europa as well, if people look that up in there. And you can find all the documents, and they've been translated into English. And this is all the diplomatic goings on that went on leading up to the war. And you can see that this Danzig question is exactly what led to it, and how the Poles refused to come over and discuss it. I mean, the Germans were so certain that they would be found to have fought a just war, and that that they weren't the ones guilty. It was the Allies that were the aggressors. And that's what these documents were for. But when it came to the Nuremberg trials, they just refused to allow them. They picked and choose what they were going to allow and what they weren't going to allow, didn't they?
Exactly. Yeah, well, it was short time, weren't it, to be honest? War criminals totally. Were actually trained, supposed war criminals. I mean, we all know about what the Russians did now. And they were one of the judges.
Oh, yeah, it's a total kangaroo court. But that's another subject for another day, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the next comment comes from someone called Duca Augusto. And he's made quite a long comment with quite a few points in it. But his first point is that Germany today is not in a crisis. So would you like to address that one, Dennis?
Well, that's probably because he doesn't realise what's actually going on. Germany is occupied today, and I've had a look into this, and when you look back over the history of since World War II of Germany, you've had all the trauma of the cities being firebombed, the traumas of all the rapes, what went on by the Russian soldiers. By the end of the war, this is a pretty messed up nation. They were completely broken. And then you had 5 years after the war where Germany was just like a prison camp, where the Allies went in there and said, you do what as we say. There was no such thing as emigration. Nobody could leave the country. And of course, the Allies went in. Also, the returning Jews went in, and they replaced all the people that Hitler replaced them with. They replaced vice versa. And so from taking over all the media, all the publishing and everything like that, this is a country now which is like probably wandering around in a coma, to be quite honest. It took that much. And yet, when you go further down history and you look that they had to absorb, say, for instance, East Germany, and then later on, from the time of 1945, really, once the Allies had sorted the country out, they were taking in immigrants and Muslims, changing even before this mass immigration, which has come to light lately. So I think they're the biggest Muslim part in any country in Europe, even before this immigration. So this is a country which has been changed as well culturally, and with all the trauma, all of a sudden, we're looking at a country which is thriving. And I cannot, for the life of me, don't get me wrong, the German people, I love the German people, but they took such a whack during that World War. And since then, things have happened which other countries just would not have been able to sustain. And when I look at the other parts of Europe now, with Greece and, Spain and even France has a worry over their economy, how the hell has Germany maintained this means of being a powerhouse, especially when it's known to me that they're run by, the banks and Rothschilds, etc. And I was under great suspicion of them being maintained falsely. And like I think I mentioned last week, the leader of the EU did come out with a line and said that Germany only exists because of Israel, because, keep the Jews in Israel going. And with all the reparations as well, I forgot to add as well, they have to pay the World War I reparations, we have to pay the World War II reparations. So this is a huge amount on this country, and yet they're still a powerhouse. And then we find out that suddenly Israel is receiving, two free submarines, a part payment on a third submarine, and they've got a couple more submarines coming in a couple of years' time. So I'm looking at the point where, it's not only Germany, by the way, but Germany, to me, looks like it's been sustained to be able to create this wealth to keep Israel in the luxury that they used to. And America are having the same problem, because a country which is in financial situation as they are at the moment, giving billions to Israel. So I don't believe it's just Germany what's got this problem. I think most of the countries in Europe are all Zionist, led by Zionist governments. Even the UK. So I'm going to look further into the UK commitments to Israel as well, because I've got a feeling that after World War II, all these countries were taken over, replaced by the Allies with their governments, are all now feeding Israel already. We don't need a new world order. It's already happening.
Well, I agree with all of that, and I'll just reiterate the fact that the German people are being replaced. They're being replaced by these non-whites. We've had 1 million of them flood in there last year. They've got a very low birth rate. You can measure whether people are in crisis by their birth rate, whether they're actually reproducing. If people are in captivity, they don't tend to reproduce. And Germany's been under an occupation by the Allies since the end of the war. It was under occupation by the Soviets, and with a big song and dance that the wall had come down, and they were no longer under occupation by the Soviets. But there's never been any rejection of the occupation by the Allies. So this government, it's an occupational government over the people. And this is why they're doing such dreadful things to them, replacing them, making it illegal for them to criticize the government on the internet. They've even written it into the constitution that no nationalist parties can ever get into government. So what that's actually saying is that no parties that actually represent the people they're supposed to be representing can actually be elected. Mm-hmm. So if that isn't a crisis, I was going to say,
we've got all these laws still about the Holocaust where you can't even look into it, you know. So it's all, nothing's changed from 1945, you know.
Yeah, it's still exactly the same. So I think we can, you know, quite justifiably say that Germany is in a crisis. The whole of Europe is in a crisis, but Germany particularly because of what happened after the war.
They can crash it any time. That's the problem. These bankers, they can crash financial systems so that they can clean up and pick up things for, you know, cheap once people are in debt. So it's the balance. It's all about whether they decide Germany's going to fall or not. And it's in their hands. It's not in the people's hands. That's the problem.
Well, yeah, the reason why Germany's economy is good is so that they can pay it all out to Israel.
Exactly.
So that's the simple fact of it. Well, the next point he makes is that you talk about how the mainstream media manipulates people. And then he says, but your video manipulates people.
I'm biased to that one. I mean, I just think truth moves people, not manipulates them. And people there's enough people that have seen that video who were convinced. They were quite intelligent enough to go on and research themselves and come back and have admitted to being absolutely flabbergasted. And right at all.
Well, the production values are no different to the professional stuff. So the reason why people are moved by it is because, as you say, Dennis, it's the truth. You know, the production values are the same, aren't they?
Well, the thing is that most people, I'm pretty sure, when they see the truth, know the truth. And a lot of people have said about the documentary that it's a documentary which joins all the dots. You know, there's always been a nagging kind of a feeling to the version of the Allies, and some things just didn't add up. And either been skipped round or just glossed over, and just wasn't quite right. And they've watched this documentary, and it's made more sense than any other documentary they've ever watched. And these aren't my words; these are regular comments which people can view. So, you know, to me, it's just people being moved out of the area where the Allies had them pinned and with this other version. And now they've come out of that and they've seen what they've seen as the truth and are shocked and stunned. I don't think there's any real manipulating going on. I mean, the music's nice, but so is Hollywood music.
Well, yeah, the difference is that what you're putting across there is factually accurate and people can check that. After this, he brings up some of the Hollywood sort of myths, really. He mentions superiority of race, ultra-nationalism, the motivation of violence, going to war to solve things, Lebensraum. Do you want to tackle some of those subjects?
Well, the thing is about this myth about Nazi Germany, you're quite right. I mean, we all know today who the real race thinks superior to everybody else, you know, because they believe that they're chosen by God. And this is never mentioned during World War II. It's always this Aryan, you know, we're the main people of the world. We're going to rule the world eventually. And it's like many things really, like, you know, they've twisted things over onto the Germans, which they actually believe themselves. So, you know, and this violence thing, like, I mean, people, the picture what people are given in Nazi Germany is this vicious dictator takes over, and if you don't do as you're told, you're going to really suffer. And then, you know, they might show the odd clips of some people getting some rough treatment in the streets of Berlin. There's very little of it. But you know, at the end of the day, you've got to look at the figures. The crime figures came down. You look at the pictures of people when they see Hitler actually driving past, that the faces are glowing. Because for once, in a long, long time, they've actually had food put on the table quite regularly. Because with the recession after World War I, with the Versailles treatment being pretty horrendous, Germans struggled not just during World War One, but after World War One until Hitler came to power. And suddenly they had somebody there who guaranteed them food. The nation's youth were taken aside and given, like, you know, similar to what the Scouts did in England, like, you know, where they had meat and sausage and they could get fit, and the girls were all given, you know, certain places where they could go and dance, and suddenly, you know, the country was vibrant. And I once remember reading somebody in the German army, they couldn't believe at the start of the war with the British, they couldn't believe just how underfed they were, because the Germans by that time, like, were, you know, we're all, you know, most vibrant, healthy nation in Europe. And I can believe it as well, because in Britain at that time, you still had the workhouses going, you know. So this wasn't a place of great national health.
Well, this was the whole point of it, was doing what was best for the nation and obeying natural law. And one of the points he says, ultranationalism, well, that would be doing what is best for the nation in everything, making certain that everything is what's best for your people. Yeah, what's wrong with doing what's best for your people? When he says superiority of race, well, they wanted to be the best race. Every race should want to be the best race. They should always be struggling to be the absolute best that they can.
Exactly.
Yeah. The individual should do that, and the race should do that. When you say Lebensraum, I that meant room for the people. They knew they were going to expand. They knew that their people were going to reproduce. And all the other countries in Europe had colonies. You had colonies all around the world. You had the British Empire that had half of the world. The American Empire. All they were talking about was having a part of Russia that they could develop, because Russia had a huge landmass that was hardly populated and was very backward. If the Germans had been there, they would have raised the level of civilization. And the standard of living to quite to the same standard as it was in Germany. So the Russians around that area would most definitely have benefited from that. This is the difference.
For sure.
And finally, he says that fascism cannot bring peace, but only war. But the whole of life is a struggle, isn't it? You know, the whole of life is a struggle.
I mean, how can you just say fascism brings war? I don't know, because communism's killed more people, and more ordinary people, by the way, than any other ideology.
Well, I think just war is fought to defeat something that's evil, which is what he was doing on the Eastern Front. And also, a just war is fought to defend your nation, which is what he was doing towards the West, wasn't he? He was defending himself from the Allies and at the same time trying to protect Europe from the evils of communism. So I would say that
was the big threat. Yeah. I mean, someone said to me about Hitler, and I said this to him. I said, everything Hitler did was about freedom. He saved Spain from communism in 1936. He opened up the churches in the Ukraine. You know, he gave people new life and work and jobs and food when he first came to power. He opened up everything. You know, this is what Hitler did, and yet he's been criticised.
Well, this is just it. He's continually criticised. But the next comment that I have is from Richard Graham, and I think I've got an answer to this one. He's just basically saying how wicked Churchill and Bomber Harris were. Now, I would agree. I'd say Churchill was particularly wicked, and they're just about to put his face on a £5 note. I'm not advising this, but the fact that Churchill's face is on a £5 note could be used for promotional purposes in some way, to alerting people to what sort of a traitor Churchill actually was. And as far as Bomber Harris is concerned, yes, he did some wicked things. But the thing with Bomber Harris is that he was defending his country, and he had to obey orders and make the worst war possible in the hopes to get the war over as quickly as possible and to let his country win. So he was actually doing his job. It was the politicians that were at fault. The men that were in the army were just defending their army. I mean, he was going out there risking his life and limb, as were all the Air Force. Churchill wasn't risking any life or limb. Churchill was hiding out the way, getting drunk, wearing women's underwear. He didn't have a courageous bone in his fat, flabby, feminine body, to be honest. But Bomber Harris.
If this is Churchill listening, those are his words, not mine. totally agree. I mean, to an extent, I've got agreements with Bomber Harris, but the bottom line does lie with Churchill. Churchill is the one who makes the final decision, and he took great delight in firebombing practically every city in Berlin, which was obviously with the incendiary bombs targeting civilians. And that's not the only thing he's done. You know, there's other things he's done as well, which have been well hidden. So at the end of the day, he worked for the Rothschilds. He was in their debt, and he was their puppet. So I suppose next time you see a £5 note with Churchill on, just, I don't know, you can't really deface it, can you? Right, traitor on it, I'm not sure.
Might be illegal to deface it. We're not suggesting doing anything illegal, but just think about the fact.
I'll suggest that, though.
Just think about the fact that Winston Churchill's face will be on the new £5 notes. Okay. The next one we have is from Ted Hoffman. And he's interested in how were these accounts that challenge the mainstream narrative discovered, and where should people look if they're wanting to do this sort of research for themselves?
Well, the thing is that the internet was the key to it all. Without the internet, it would have been impossible. But over a couple of years, once the internet got going and people started uploading information, then, you know, it was all there. It was all there to be seen, but a lot of it was hidden. A lot of it was buried. A lot of it I knew before the internet, and then so I knew where to look for it to actually find it and confirm it myself. So paragraph 26, like, we list all the sources. And for people, I've got to be honest, you know, when it shows the happy pictures of Hitler, which you never normally see, I did that on purpose because I knew that a lot of people, especially from, the chosen few, would have been looking at these sources. And I took great delight in putting pictures of Hitler, of his best moments, all the way through part 26. So I do plead guilty on that part.
Well, as you say, people can look at all the evidence for this. It's all listed at the end of the documentary. I would recommend the Institute for Historical Review, listening to early Carolyn Jaeger podcasts, looking up Mark Weber stuff, Ernst Zundel. The internet is full of information on this. Justice for Germans, I found, was a very good site just for collecting information from elsewhere. There's NS Europa. There used to be a really good one called Nazi.org. I think there may have been some copyright issues with that, but that was a massive library full of treasures, basically, to do with National Socialism. But just look around on the internet is the way to find it. And also look at bookstores as well. I know they're not so easy to find nowadays, but at least you can find some of them on the internet as well.
Well, I think there's one. I think it's GRLine Books Online or something like that. They've got quite a lot about the Danzig situation as well.
Okay, so the next one that we have is from Jake Dredd, and he's talking about dictatorships, and he's one of these people that says, oh, dictatorship, and he's instantly frightened just because it's the word dictatorship. And he says, show me one that worked. And I thought, I thought instantly, what about monarchies? Monarchies worked for thousands of years. They were dictatorships. So do you want to talk a little bit about dictatorship for a bit, Dennis?
Well, people don't realise that democracy is actually dictatorship in disguise. As the old saying goes, it's like two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for supper. It's an easy way of manipulating people for the people in power to stay in power without even being known. I mean, you look at America and England today, there's no difference between the two parties. No matter who you vote for, you're getting the same crew. So democracy in itself is a dictatorship, which this guy obviously doesn't understand. And if you're looking at dictators, I suppose in the past few years, what was the guy in Venezuela called who was getting comments from Bush at the time? He didn't seem a bad one because he was for the people. He kind of lifted up the country. Chavez, I felt, did quite a good job until he died of cancer. One or two, it all depends, really. Like, I mean, if you're going to call Stalin a dictator and go by his standards, then, you know, it's a problem. But Hitler was for the people. I feel Chavez was for the people. And it's like anything, really. Like, if you get somebody in who is either for himself, then you're going to have a nightmare. But if you're going to get somebody like him, you know, who sincerely wants to help the country and is a nationalist at heart, then to me, you know, probably one of the best ways a country can go.
Well, I think that's the benevolent dictator and the tyrannical dictator are two different things. A benevolent dictatorship, it means that the guy at the top, he's responsible. He's responsible for everything. This was the thing with Adolf Hitler. He was responsible for everything. I mean, at the end of the war, he took his own life. He was responsible. Yeah. And he was also voted in by the people. But if you look at Stalin and communism, they called themselves the dictatorship of the proletariat. So they would just blame the proletariat if anything went wrong. That kept going for quite some time, and it devolved into just, you know, the bankers running things with these Jewish puppets who were given legitimacy by these fake elections that they had. But that was your tyrannical dictatorship, and looking at Hitler, that was your benevolent dictatorship.
Well, can I just say that before I forget? I noticed online last night, I was listening to Jim Myers and Alex Jones. Now, if you remember, during the current documentary, what I'm doing, like I said about democracy being, you know, a dictatorship in disguise, and when we discovered that the neocons were actually Trotskyites, you had two sets, you've got the Stalinists and you've got the Trotskyites. I was watching Jim Myers and Alex Jones doing an interview last night, and could you believe it? Jim Myers is actually coming out and saying that the neocons were National Socialists, and Alex Jones was on to say, oh yeah, under Strauss in Chicago, you know, these were National Socialists. Whether or not they've seen my documentary and thought we better discredit it, I don't know. But I just thought I'd throw that one in before I forgot, because that's another one we've got to contend with now.
Well, yeah, constantly. They're calling the EU Nazis. They're calling the EU Nazis, aren't they? It's all Nazis because Hitler was going to unite Europe. So the fact that these bankers have united Europe is the same thing. They haven't united Europe. They've put Europe into slavery, basically. The National Socialists did away with usury. They did away with being enslaved to the bankers. And the plans that they had for a united Europe, they were nationalists. Yeah, they wouldn't have done away with people's national sovereignty. They might have had a voluntary union, but they wouldn't have done away with people being responsible for making their own laws, etc. I think this dictatorship thing, it's hidden, isn't it? There's always somebody that's in charge. Not in charge, but ruling over everyone else. It's just that at the moment, it's hidden. They pretend that there isn't a group at the top that's ruling over everyone else. They pretend that we're ruling ourselves. Because we vote in elections, then that's us ruling ourselves. Well, the subject cannot be both sovereign and subject. You cannot be sovereign and citizen. There is always a force that's above and a force that's below.
It's never been explained how Churchill got the job. Who gave him the job? And who got rid of the king at the same time? There must be a higher power somewhere, because Churchill wasn't elected. Somebody said, you've got the job, so which means there's a higher power. And that's usually the City of London, because they pull all the strings anyway.
We struggle against powers and principalities in high places, Dennis.
Yes, exactly.
And so did Hitler. Right, well, let's move on to the next one. The next one is by John Citizen. And he says that Berlin was actually the artistic capital of the world before Hitler effed it all up. And then he fills his comment with a lot more foul-mouthed language. And again, then he points out dictatorship. So what would you say to that, Dennis, that Berlin was actually the artistic capital of the world
I've actually heard this before, where National Socialist Germany were accused by somebody of destroying the culture of the 1920s and 30s of Germany. And when you look at what that culture happened to be, you know, when the truth comes out, then you realize just what a good job Hitler did, even before they got to power. I mean, Goebbels was in Berlin trying to rally support and did an incredible job, and even got banned at one point, the National Socialists, and even then continued this struggle to clean out Berlin, where streets weren't fit for families to walk, where kids were sent out by their parents to prostitute themselves because they had enough money, where you could, anyone from around the world could arrive and you name a perverse sex act, you could buy that for less than $10. So if that's Hitler killing an artistic Berlin, then he should have burnt the place down, if you ask me.
Well, if you think about what they actually had there, they had the first plays to do with divorce, the first plays to do with homosexuality. That was the birthplace of this really ugly, horrific art that they call modern art. I mean, these images that don't actually represent anything. I mean, they had exhibitions of this foul art that the Jews were producing. And we see it all around us today. You see these wealthy Jews talking about how wonderful this piece of art is. And it's just a mess. I mean, it's degenerated so far now that they're just sort of playing around in feces and calling it art, or urinating in bottles and sticking crucifixes in it and then calling that art. I mean, all of that started in Germany. To say that that was a culture, an artistic culture, that there was no culture in that. A culture comes from a nation of people, and that wasn't the German culture. That was the Jewish anti-culture that was infecting the German culture. The drugs, the debauchery that went on there, they were all taking heroin and cocaine and
pedophilia.
The pedophilia. The children that were being prostituted to make enough money for their parents to live. You had people dying on the street, bodies in the street. You had mothers and daughters having to prostitute themselves because the country had got so far into debt with the inflation that was going on. And then you had all these Jews moving in from around the world because they could see what their kinsmen had done to the country. So they would all move in with money from outside and buy everything up. And they would buy up all the land, and the farmers would lose their inherited land that had been in their family hands for centuries.
Generations, and the
Jews were taking everything over.
Yeah, and every homosexual from all the various countries, and even England, would flood there, because at that time, I mean, people think that, Germany just persecuted homosexuals. There was no country around that time openly pushed homosexuality. It was all looked on as depraved at the time, and so they flooded to Berlin because this was their utopia. Hitler just saw this wasn't German at all, and did what he did to change things. And to be fair, they were well outnumbered. There was something like 200,000, communists in Berlin. And I think when Goebbels arrived, got off the train station, there's probably 150, 200 National Socialists at most. But these people did change things, and eventually people, the Jews started moving out, and these Hollywood people, they shot off to Hollywood. They probably came back after the war. But, depraved. I mean, it was Babylon, weren't it? Like Hollywood is today.
Yeah, Sodom and Gomorrah or Babylon. You did an extra piece to do in your series,
yes,
Dennis, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Babylon, I think, or Hitler Gets Rid of Babylon. I can't remember the exact title of it. One of the things...
Babylon Before Hitler.
Babylon Before Hitler, yeah, that's it. One of the other things they did, all these perverts that were calling themselves doctors and professors were also moved to Germany, and they were claimed to be doing sex research. This was your Wilhelm Reich and various early versions of Kinsey in America that did all these experiments and was taking records of pedophiles and how many children they'd abused and all that sort of thing. And that was going on there in Germany at that time as well. That was the predecessor to all of that. It was when they moved out from Germany, because Adolf Hitler took power, that they then went to America and started doing it in America. And that's when you get after that you get Kinsey and you get the Frankfurt Institute, and all these people, or the Frankfurt Institute guys were in Germany at first, and they were involved in this, all these perverted sexual experiments that they were doing. And today we think of artistic, and we think of these artistic types as being like that because we've been degenerated. Artistic types were never like that. They used to paint religious epics. The church used to requisition artists to paint these glorious works of art that depicted religious motifs or mythic scenes from our cultural history. And that's what art was about. It wasn't about degenerative sex or perverseness or trying to make things as disgusting as possible. It wasn't about that at all. So it was the highlight of that.
Even Hitler painted the Madonna and Child. You know, this is the type of art that, you know, he looked upon as true German.
Well, yeah, you can see from that that he wasn't against art, was he?
Not at all.
I mean, it's quite enlightening to see what he painted. You can tell from the Madonna and Child that he was highly respectful of Christianity. It was obviously an important part of his life, or he wouldn't have painted it.
Exactly. Stalin would never paint it, would he, let's be honest?
No.
I mean, it wasn't interesting, would it?
Well, you can't really think of any Russian art around that time. You'd hardly be wanting to paint, would you, if you're in a Bolshevik state? You'd hardly be feeling creative.
Oh, yeah, you're too busy killing people.
No, it would be like being in prison. Let's move on to the next one. The next one is from somebody calling themselves In Space Evil. And they appear to believe in the Holohoax. And his point is that Otto Ohlendorf and Rudolf Hess admitted to gassing Jews, admitted to exterminating Jews in the camps. And this is quite a common thing, actually. People will bring this up and say, oh, yes, but there are all these confessions that they gassed millions of Jews. So do you want to answer that one, Dennis?
Well, yeah, I mean, last week we were talking about this ministry letter which went round to the BBC, which talked about the best way of... we know what the Bolsheviks are going to do when they get to Europe on past experience. The best way to combat it is not to keep denying it, but to build up, you know, even bigger atrocities by the enemy, which is consequently what they did. And again, if I just go back to this epic documentary of Thames television back in the 70s, you know, once you can see by the 70s, the Holocaust had come into full gear, and they had people under eyewitnesses saying that they saw the flames coming out of the chimneys in Auschwitz, and this other woman is absolutely certain that there was soap being used, you know, to turn these Jews into bars of soap, and all this over this period of time, with the internet as well, you can all verify this, that the soap in 1990, the soap story was at last announced a complete lie by the Holocaust Museum in Israel. And various other people, and obviously on this thing about, you know, the flames coming out of the chimneys at Auschwitz, people can now see this chimney, which was built after the war, was not even connected to the building, it just went into the ground. So it must be a magic fire what come out of that chimney. Not that fire does come out, it's smoke what comes out, so we got that wrong as well. So, you know, you can see that the way that it was all put into place, ready for this machinery to eventually go into operation. And then, of course, they wrapped a law around it, the only event in history, very similar to me saying that, you know, I believe that the Texans did not win the Alamo, and so now, you know, you face 3 years in prison or longer. It's the only event in history where, you know, has been protected by a law and people are imprisoned by denouncing it or denying it.
Well, I think also that there's evidence to prove that these confessions were extracted by torture, and that the families involved were threatened with rape and murder. The guys that were being interrogated had their testicles smashed. I think there's something like 100 out of 120 of them had their testicles smashed beyond repair. And when Rudolf Hess came to signing his confession, I think he talked about a place that didn't exist. I think the confession was written in English when he was German, didn't speak English. Yeah. There was things, and he put things into that confession to show that it was a false confession. He was talking about things that didn't exist, places that weren't actually there. And the guy that was interrogating them, I think you've actually got him on the film talking about the torture.
He wrote a book. Yeah, I openly bragged about how they did torture the Germans, because they never thought they'd get any comeback later on. You know, they just thought, well, we've won the war now, and no one's going to ever try and investigate, etc. But obviously, over years, these stories can all be ripped to shreds, which is why this law is still wrapped around it, not giving any official means of actually seeing if what was said was true, which I'm pretty sure a lot of people, you know, there's enough evidence now on the internet they can find themselves to the very least start to doubt it, at the very least.
Well, I think they must have been told to actually do this by their superiors. They must have been told to interrogate them in this way, just like in America, they're told to waterboard, you know, these Muslim criminals. Back then, you're talking 70 years ago, they were told to smash the guy's testicles beyond repair to get this confession out of them. So if they're going to then write books about it 50 or 60 years later, obviously nobody had told them to keep quiet about it. They thought that they were doing the right thing. It was these nasty Germans. They were guilty of this crime, you know. That's why we had to get this confession.
Yeah,
it's terrible, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, never looked on a torch as the best way of getting information, because I'm sure if somebody were torturing me, I'd say anything to stop them torturing me. So whether it be true or not, you know, it's up for grabs.
Well, that's just it. You know, you are going to say anything when you're tortured like that. And if you look back at the Middle Ages, when we did routinely torture people, we weren't doing that out of just sadism. That was done in order to get the truth. And you know that because after they had been tortured and they'd said what they had to say, they were nursed back to health again. And then they were asked whether what they said while they were under torture was true or not.
Apart from one incident, of Guy Fawkes. I mean, they tortured him and they got the truth out of him, but I'm not convinced they nursed him back to health.
Well, maybe they had the evidence to prove that. But he talks about this in that book about Jewish ritual slaughter, Bloody Passover. And it talks about that they had strict laws that they had to observe when they were doing this torture. They would only do it to somebody that they believed was guilty. And they would do that so because they thought that if they did give them just that extra little push, they would be more inclined to confess. And then after they were nursed back to health again, they would say, were you telling the truth or not? If they said they weren't, then maybe they would torture them again, maybe they wouldn't. But if they said, well, yes, I did, you know, I confessed to that, then they would take their punishment. But they did nurse them back to health to make sure that they'd actually got the truth out of them. It wasn't about sadism. It was about wanting to get to the truth. So something had seriously changed between the Middle Ages and the 20th century for them to just be torturing these guys and then getting them to sign these fake confessions. You know, something had really gone rotten within Britain during that time. And I think we know what that rottenness was brought about by as well, don't we, Dennis?
Exactly. Exactly. We certainly do.
Yeah, it came over sort of about the time when the Bank of England was started.
Yeah, that's right. It's just as in Germany, you know, the culture of Germany was changed and Hitler saw that. Then it was the same with the English culture also had changed by that time into this other infiltrated culture.
Well, this is just it. It's recognising it, isn't it? It's recognising that the culture had changed.
America's the same now, yeah.
Yeah, Germany had a Hitler who recognised what was being done to the culture and he was able to get his people behind him. But Britain has never had anyone really big enough that's recognised what's gone on and been able to get the people behind them. That's what it comes down to. If you don't have an ethnically homogenous nation, if you allow other nations to come in, they will form a state within a state. And, you know, the Jews are no different to other races in this aspect. But the really dangerous fact is that they are such experts at it. That's what it is. They are experts at it. And because that's the way that they've lived for thousands of years.
2,000 years.
Yeah, within other people's nations, they've been the ferment of revolution. They've always been wanting to tear down the nation that they're in and to just make as much money as possible out of it and then move on to the next one. They just have this desire to be doing what's anti-nature and what's basically working for chaos. And this goes back to the rejection of Christ or Christ rejecting them. This rejection of the Logos, that's what it boils down to, rejection of order and the embracing of chaos. And they've done that ever since. And now we're living in these end times, and we can see it all. We're the ones that can see it all, and the rest of our nations are still asleep. But thankfully, there are still the watchmen, there are still the shepherds that are awake, me and you, Dennis, and our listeners, and people that come across this stuff, and your documentary, and it wakes them up. Okay, well, let's move on to the next one. A comment by somebody calling themselves Alex Martin. He's of the opinion that Hitler was really bad. He didn't always do good things. And the evidence he cites for this is that Rommel didn't like him. Ernst Rommel. Do you know much about Ernst Rommel?
Well, the only side of the story we've got is from the Allies saying that he didn't like him. And I think the story went, I think Hitler was supposed to have found out that he was one of the few generals which had plotted against him with the bomb, or went off and he survived. He told Rommel, because this is the Allied version anyway, he told Rommel, because you're a national hero, we'd rather you committed suicide rather than, drag you through the course and blacken your name. And so this is what the Allies said, he committed suicide because of Hitler's pressure on him. But I mean, this is only what we've got from the Allies. We haven't had another story from the other side. So I'm going to take it with a pinch of salt, because everything I've found what the Allies have said has been a lot of crap. So.
Yeah, he realised that he was plotting against him. I'm getting a bit of distortion at your end, Dennis. I'm just wondering whether I should call you back. We've only got a few minutes to go.
Sure, really. Call.
Well, you're sounding okay now, actually. The next point that we've got here, somebody called Q-Clips has come up with something which I think is pretty good, actually. And he says that we are accused of being Holocaust deniers, but we shouldn't actually accept that term, because denial means denial of the truth. And we're not denying the truth. We're denouncing lies. So what we are is Holocaust denouncers rather than Holocaust deniers. And I hadn't thought of that before, but that's pretty good, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but, they're calling us the name, so whether or not they'll decide to change it, I doubt very much. It's like the Nazi thing, they're never going to change calling us Nazis. And I don't think they'll ever change calling us Holocaust deniers, but I do see where it's coming from. But, that we're not a problem, it's the people calling us.
I think it's quite good to embrace what they're calling us as well. They call us white supremacists. Yes, we're white supremacists. Call us a Holocaust denier. Holocaust denier. It doesn't matter what names you call us, because we know that we're based in the truth. We stand on the truth, firmly on the truth, and we speak the truth, because we know that truth is eternal. We're fighting on the right side. We're fighting on the side of what's pure and good. And we know that they've been deceived. Our own people have been deceived and turned against us by believing all these lies. There was another comment in there where somebody was saying, how come I believed all these lies? How was it possible that I never questioned why Hitler would go into all these countries in the first place? Why did I just assume he must have been mad or never thought about it? And the answer to that is obviously just this full spectrum brainwashing that we get. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Brainwashing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people have actually lost sleep over watching that documentary and realizing, the facts are true. And it's been quite hurting, to unravel the brain because of how this mass brainwashing has taken place over the last 70 years, just a drip, 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 either through the newspapers or through the TVs or movies. It's always been there. I mean, you just wouldn't believe it. Once you see it, you realize just how bad it was. And this mass mind control of the world has taken place and up to a point where everything is accepted, even though there's a law. The alarm bell should start ringing there when there's a law to say you can't investigate. Even with all that, and then the evidence of the, one of being leaked out by people like David Cole, etc. You know, alarm bells have to start ringing. But still, there's a huge number who just accepts the fact that Hitler was evil and the Germans. I mean, there was one incident. The wife has said, "I'm going to tell you this one." There was one incident. It was like a dating of millionaires on TV. They had this program, and this one was obviously infatuated with this guy. The minute he said he was German, there was like a switch in her head just turned off, and it was like she was talking to a paedophile. This mind control has got to everybody, where it's a certain buzzwords, and certainly it was German with this woman, and she just didn't want to know the guy. He was a millionaire, and she was quite happy with him until she found out. It was just so unbelievable.
That's how strong it is. It is really strong. I think it can be quite upsetting when you realise the truth. That's why people are unwilling to face up to it. I know people that won't watch the documentary. They'll keep pushing it to one side. I think that's because they're frightened. They're frightened to accept the fact that they've actually been wrong all this time.
The truth hurts.
Yeah.
That's the saying.
Well, that's the proof of it, isn't it? That's exactly. One of the things that proves it, that this is the truth, because it is hurtful, and because many of us have been following it and have been fallen for it, and we've fallen for these lies, and that hurts. And some of the things we've said in the past and or done in the past to support these lies, that hurts. And people are so, you know, they really don't want to turn around and change their views, especially not if they've been standing on a platform promoting these views. And then they find out
lost relatives, you know, the grandfathers, whatever you like. It's hard to bear of why they died was not right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a strong one. That a very strong one in older generations, people that were nearer to the time that lost relatives. To realise that their relatives lost their lives for no good reason. They don't want to believe that. They want to cling on to this idea that they were fighting this noble war.
Yeah.
That they were defending democracy. And the huge holes in that, such as Stalin being given Eastern Europe and communism.
Yeah.
Churchill handing that over to him at the Yalta Conference. Yeah. These huge, glaring discrepancies with this tale that we've been told, people just don't see them. They don't want to learn about them. What they want to see is the world at war, isn't it, Dennis? They want to be told that had a just war.
Exactly. Well, that brings it all together for everybody. A lot of people are quite happy after seeing that. That's the truth. But take Churchill, for instance. Churchill will come out and say, criticise the Soviets in one speech, and yet he's handed over Eastern Germany to him. And in another speech, you'll say Christianity, is at stake in this war. Well, it was, but not the way he meant it. You know what I'm saying? So Churchill was very contradictory, and in fact, he goes as far as saying he was a liar, because he knew exactly what was going on. He knew exactly about the Bolsheviks, and yet he handed over Eastern Germany, without a problem, without a conscience. And so did Roosevelt.
Well, I think the challenge now then is since Churchill is going to be in people's minds with him appearing on this £5 note, is to point out to people just what Churchill did, how he lost us the empire, went to war against Germany. I mean, you can tailor what you're saying to the people as to just how much they actually know about what happened. I mean, if they know nothing at all, just point out that he completely lost us the British Empire. What's he doing on a £5 note? He lost us more than anyone else ever in our history, territory-wise. And another thing to point out is the fact that straight after the war, everybody voted him out. There was an election, and he wasn't voted back in, was he?
Like in the valley in South Wales, I can't see them being very receptive to the Churchill on the back of a £5 note, because they all celebrated when he died.
Well, yeah, he shot these miners that were striking for better money. He did dreadful things. So point all these things out to people when you see his face on the £5 note. Right, well, we're coming to the end of the podcast now. Dennis, do you want to let people know where they can find your work?
Yeah, sure. RareStoryNeverTold.tv for this documentary we've just been talking about. And Communism by the Back Door, a follow-up, you can catch on my YouTube channel of Dennis Wise.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on once again, Dennis. Thank you, listeners, for listening. Tune in next Friday for another edition of Truth Will Out Radio.
to Radio Arian.